Thank you. We're joined as usual by Rodan Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Red Sox Nation.
And University of Rhode Island political science professor Maureen Moakley. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning, everyone.
We're pleased to welcome as our special guest the Attorney General of Rhode Island, Peter Kilmartin. Thanks for joining us, General.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
There's a lot happening in the 2014 race for governor. Providence Mayor Angel Taveras announced his campaign this week. Moderate Party founder Ken Block is running as a Republican. The GOP mayor of Cranston, Alan Fung, is set to announce his campaign Monday. And meanwhile, State Treasurer Gina Raimondo is expected to announce her Democratic campaign later this year. And Clay Pell is also considering a Democratic run. Let's start with General Kilmartin. Who do you plan to be supporting for governor in 2014?
In my opinion, we haven't even reached the starting gate yet. There are horses lining up. They want to get into the starting gate. We've already seen horses drop out and get scratched before they've even approached the gate. Everyone assumed Governor Chafee was going to run for re-election. He pulled out early. So we haven't even approached the starting gate. And really, the way I look at it, not to mix the metaphors, a lot of this right now is inside baseball, and people are more concerned about the baseball we saw with the Red Sox winning the World Series.
Absolutely. Maureen, what do you see as noteworthy about the governor's race at this very early phase?
Sort of two things. One is, really, we have a group of potential candidates that are young, energetic, and very talented, and some of them are doing good work now. Added to that is the curious possibility that we're going to have some more dynasty politics, particularly when it comes to Claiborne Pell. It seems to me somewhat presumptuous that while we have talented people that are working in the trenches, the idea that someone's going to come in and save us strikes me as a little presumptuous.
How about you, Scott? What is most significant at this stage of the governor's race?
Well, you really can't point to a lot because, as the general said, we're really in the hot stove league aspect, to use another baseball metaphor. The only thing you can really point to now are polls, endorsements, and money. And that's what we talk about because we don't have anything else to go on. The polls only show this far out really how well-known these people are. They don't tell you a whole lot else. The money is important because I think it does show that State General Treasurer Gina Raimondo is out to a good jump in that area. Endorsements? Well, we have the Firefighters Union going for Mayor Taveras, but there's an awful long way to go till we see where organized labor, which is always a strong interest group in the Democratic primary, long, long way to go here.
Let's go to some questions for our special guest, Attorney General Peter Kilmartin. As we know, there's been this frittata in Exeter over the issuance of concealed carry permits. Do you agree with those people who say that it's your office, the Attorney General's office, that should be the ones issuing these permits for the town, which doesn't have a police department, rather than the town clerk?
Well, we supported the cities and towns and the police chiefs in the last legislative session to say, let all of the gun permits come through the Attorney General's office. And I have no problem with that. Exeter's unique. They do not have a police chief. They have a town clerk who's been there for many years. She doesn't have access to the criminal databases that might be necessary for this to do the background checks. So it does make sense to, if you're not going to go to the AG's office, at least allow the state police or another agency to do those background checks.
Let's go to Scott.
The conclusion of the Jason Plur case. Governor Chafee, as you know, got into a fairly heated dispute with the federal prosecutors about whether the death penalty should be used or not. In the end, the plea bargain gave him life in prison without parole. How do you feel about how that case concluded?
Needless to say, as you just alluded to, there were a lot of unexpected parts to the case, the governor being a major part of that. We could have gotten a plea early on in the state side of the case. He was willing to come to the state, plead to life without parole, but the feds had the case from the beginning and wanted to pursue it down that line. I think the governor brought up some great legal points. They were decided in the circuit, and they had the resolution to the case. The good resolution is that the family is satisfied that justice is being served and that he will be serving his life in federal prison.
Let's go to Maureen.
I want to ask you, why hasn't your office been more proactive in dealing with the sex clubs that we have? Why haven't you proposed either regulatory or statutory reforms that can do something about cleaning up this, I think, awful kind of aspect of our city life? Everyone's so afraid of gambling, but I see these as really a blight on the city.
And by sex clubs, you're referring to what are popularly known as strip clubs.
Right.
Well, two answers to that. One is the cities and towns need to do the proper licensing, code enforcement, and have the local police on the street checking these clubs. That's first and foremost. The boots on the ground are what is most important. To your point, though, I spoke with my legislative liaison, Joey Lindbeck, the other day, and I said, put together a package where we will require background checks for anyone who is an employee or a contract employee, because they're claiming that these dancers or strippers, whatever you want to call them, are contract employees. We want to make sure that the proper background checks are in place, proper identification is done, that we don't have human trafficking, that we don't have underage children in there. So we are going to put forward a legislative package on that.
Speaking of legislative packages, a big package was introduced earlier this year that was meant to stem gun violence in Rhode Island. You were there with Governor Chafee and legislative leaders when that package was unveiled, General Kilmartin. But in the end, only a few very modest pieces of that package became law. Is that a failure of public leadership in Rhode Island that we haven't been able to create stronger gun laws?
Over the course of time, it's been a chip at it process. For instance, when I was in the legislature, I was the one who got past the gun locker bill, where if their guns could be accessed by children or the potential, you have to keep that gun locked up at home. So there has been movement in the past. I was proud to be a leader in that. That being said, we had an opportunity this year with all the gun violence going on in the country and in our state. In our urban cities with these gangs accessing guns, I've been pushing for years to have criminal penalties assessed on juvenile people who have guns illegally, and that has fallen on deaf ears, and I'm very disappointed by it.
What about the commission? How would you judge the commission that's trying to deal with some of the proposals that the legislature put out, particularly in mental health records?
That's the focus of this commission. It's how do we have what they call NICS compliance for the people who have been adjudicated.
NICS is a national database.
Correct. Where if someone were going to buy a firearm, their name would be put into that database and they would see if there's a disqualifier.
Are you a strong supporter of that?
Oh, absolutely. We have to do that. The problems we are running into and what the legislature is going to have to do this session, and hopefully this commission will come out with a recommendation, is find a way to weigh the privacy interests of the people who are adjudicated mentally ill and make sure that they are not publicly put out there but are put into a database that the only way it will be accessed is if they actually apply for a firearm, their name's put in and it comes up.
Let's get Scott in here quickly on whether this was a failure of public leadership that Rhode Island has not made much progress in terms of gun violence and the related laws.
It's an interesting issue. I think that what's needed here, and I think I've said this before, is a group like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, a real grassroots effort by people who want stronger gun laws, because we know the NRA and the other side, the gun manufacturers, some of these folks, you know, they gave $120,000 over the last 10 years, I believe, to state legislators. That PAC is now winding down, as we know. But nonetheless, it's the old conundrum. When you have an entrenched interest, they always have something to defend, and they're going to hire good lobbyists. The only way to combat that is with an aroused public.
Let's stick with Scott here and talk about how a talk this week at Brown University by New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly was canceled after Brown University students and some other people shouted him down. The critics say that Kelly was unwelcome because of New York's controversial stop and frisk policy, which has been deemed unconstitutional. But to some others, this looks like another episode of liberal intolerance at Brown. What do you say, Scott?
Well, I wish there could have been a more civic and civil discussion. It'd be nice if 1,000 kids showed up, say, with black armbands or big protest signs and had let the commissioner have his say. Now, we all know that some of this is just undergraduate frivolity. You know, I went to school during the Vietnam War era, and it seemed everybody who came to campus who was in favor of our involvement in Southeast Asia got shouted down. So don't forget, a lot of these kids are 17, 18, 19 years old, and they'll grow up.
Maureen, you're a member of the Academy. Does this show that certain ideas are not welcome at Brown University?
Well, I think there's always ideas, given the tenor of the times, that a significant portion of the campus at Brown is relatively liberal. That said, I mean, I agree with Scott. These are young undergraduates making a lot of noise, and I applaud President Paxton, because I think she's done the right thing in terms of trying to reassemble the group and talk about civility and make this a teaching moment. So I think it's been well handled, and I think it's something that it's a continual problem for those of us in academia who are trying to wrestle with a lot of different ideas.
General Kilmartin, we know how the bombastic Christopher Young was arrested at Brown a few years ago when he disrupted a talk by Patrick Kennedy. Is there a double standard here?
Well, I think the standard, and I really don't know the details of that. I only remember the headlines on it. But I think the standard is here you had a room full of an entire auditorium of people who were being bombastic. And I think the university did the proper thing and said, we are going to not have the lecture. Everything's over. You are now free to leave. I think that was the smart and prudent act on the part of the university itself.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us on Political Roundtable. Scott?
Great to be here.
Maureen?
Thank you.
And Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Kilmartin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Robertson Foundation, continuing the commitment of its founder, Stephen Hamblett, to honest government in Rhode Island through in-depth political coverage. And if you enjoy the conversation, please visit our On Politics blog at ripr.org.